Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And joining us in the Great Midwest Bank Hotline, it is John Orlovitz, longtime member of the IndyCar scene, going back to the kart days of the late 1990s, and of course, coming out with a new book, neat book, Equus Racing's Rise and Fall. Pretty neat book, which celebrates kind of a neat, or I should say, time flies, I should say, the history of PacWest Racing. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you joining us. And PacWest Racing, of course, is that's where Scott Dixon got his start. A lot of people might not remember that, but Scott Dixon was an up and coming driver, was the youngest winner, if I recall, in Neil Kart Circuit when he won at Nazareth way back when, wasn't it?
He did set that record, and you know, longtime fans of the sport might remember when Dixon came over here in 1999. He was 18 years old, and he actually looked a lot like Paul Tracy at that age. He was kind of pudgy.
Yes.
With, you know, ginger complexion. And he drove a year of Indy Lights over here for Stefan Johansson's team. And Stefan ended up taking over as his manager and remains his manager to this day, in fact. And Johansson kind of negotiated a deal for him to join PacWest for the 2000 season. And he was teamed with Tony Renna at PacWest to run Indy Lights. And he had a really successful season. There was kind of a unspoken really with PacWest's IndyCar team in the kart series. Mauricio Guzman and Mark Blundell were in their late 30s, kind of in the twilight of their career, and the team wasn't really achieving a lot of results on the IndyCar side. And they knew that there was a possibility for one or both of them possibly to move up, and Dixon pretty comprehensively showed that he was the guy in 2000. He won six races in the Indy Lights Championship. I believe his main competition that year was Townsend Bell. And then he got promoted to the kart series in 2001, and PacWest kind of recovered from the difficulties they had in the late 90s when the Mercedes Ilmor engine program wasn't competitive or reliable. And they had Toyota engines in 2001, and as you point out, it was a pretty circumstantial win at Nazareth. Dixon was only making his third start in IndyCars. He qualified near the back, and it was a fuel mileage race. But it's interesting that even at that point in his career, when he wasn't even 21 years old yet, he was mature enough to manage a race that way. And it's kind of become a hallmark of him. He's won, you know, he won one race for PacWest, and he's won 49 races now for Chip Ganassi. And he's closing in on Mario Andretti on the all-time win list, and it's kind of mystifying to see the slump that he's been in here for the last couple of races, and it'll be interesting to see whether he can snap out of it today.
And this is a kind of interesting book. I'm looking forward to reading it because it has a definite insider's look because you worked for PacWest Racing as a PR rep, and you know, seeing that side of it, you certainly see a difference, especially with the amount of time you're with the drivers. And back then, too, the media, in certain ways was a lot bigger in certain ways, I think. And to kind of walk us through that, how that really changed, and what you initially thought when you finally got to the other side of the pit wall, so to speak, on that side of racing.
Well, there's no question that the kart series, up to the split with the Indy Racing League, when Tony George branched off and created some conflict that I think a lot of people thought was unnecessary. The kart series was flying high in the 90s. You had Nigel Mansell racing here in 93 and 94. You had the emergence of Jacques Villeneuve, who went on to become a Formula One world champion. The kart series was really doing well in the mid-90s with a ton of international attention and a ton of national and international media. I got my start working in the media. I owe a lot of my career to Nigel Mansell in the sense that I got involved in 1993 and the English media was desperate for content from Nigel Mansell. So I got to cover Nigel Mansell's first couple years over here. But by the time 97 came around, I was in a position where I had to, quote unquote, get a job, start pulling my weight. And so I got a job with PacWest as the PR guy. And I honestly, if I'm truthful, I didn't really know what I was doing for the first half of the season. I always set out to be a journalist, and I kind of achieved my dream, but in a very small time way. And going to work for PacWest, I did it for 2 years. It ended up being great for my career because when I went back into the media in 1999, it was at a much higher level, and I was able to come in as the kart series correspondent for National Speed Sport News and do some work for kart's independent website. The PacWest years were fascinating for me. It was just so educational to learn about how a racing team works. And just, you know, I always thought of it as a sport. And, of course, I've grown up and realized that it's really a business. And that's kind of unfortunate in some ways and good in others. But the 2 years at PacWest, it really gave me an insight into how teams work, how drivers work. Having known what the media looked for, it was interesting to try to service that side. I mean, I didn't get a whole lot of satisfaction out of writing press releases or pitching stories. I wanted to actually write the stories, which is ultimately why I went back into the press. But unbelievably invaluable experience, some really, really good times, especially doing functions with the drivers. I mean, if you get to spend a week with Mauricio Guglielmin in Brazil and he wins pole position for his home race, there's a lot of excitement that goes around it. And a lot of it was unexpected. I mean, I honestly, when I went there, I didn't think PacWest had run that great. I saw a couple of guys who in Formula One, and I understand that Formula One is very dictated by the cars that people drive, but I saw a couple guys that were midfielders in Formula One. But when they got over here and when they got the right package in 1997 with the right engine and the right tires and the right chassis and the right engineers, suddenly these guys were capable of winning races. And PacWest doesn't have the pedigree or the heritage of Penske or Ganassi or Newman Haas. But at the same time, it's kind of unique in the sense that Bruce McCaw was one of the first outsiders from outside of racing who came in and tried to make a go of it as a business. And ultimately that failed, but I don't think it was really down to the team itself. It was down to the circumstances and some of the decisions they made. They were too loyal to the Mercedes engine program, and ultimately that's one of the two or three key factors that put them out of business at the end of 2001.
I do have to ask you this, since you brought up Brazil and that, and it came up in conversation just a week or two ago with a bunch of buddies. We were chatting, and the subject of Mark Blundell came up and that scary crash he had at Brazil. And this is a time before Hans devices and software barriers, where he had, if I recall, it was a throttle stuck as he was coming into turns 3 and 4 at a very, very scary, and one of the hardest hits I've ever seen in an Indy car. When that happened, we were thinking the worst. I remember I was watching it with a bunch of guys, and it was a scary, scary crash. Kind of, can you give us a little background on that, or do you have any background on that crash and Blundell and on that?
Well, I do. That was in 1996. It was the first year that they raced it at Rio at the so-called, Rick Mears actually called it a roval. He was the first guy to bring that word into the lexicon because the track was actually a trapezoid-shaped track that had two short straights, two long straights, but it was opposite symmetrical at each end. In other words, the radius of turn one and two was the same as three and four, but just in opposite. And the result of it is that the guys had to brake pretty hard going into one, and they had to brake even harder going into four. And Blundell actually suffered total brake failure going into turn four. The problem, and we actually document this with a pretty significant sidebar in the book, a PacWest, or I should say a Galmer engineered part failed, and it hadn't been proper. We kind of go through that whole thing, and you know, not just that, but the emotional toll that something like that, when a project that you initiate ends up not working and puts a guy in the hospital. It was a scary crash. Mark was sidelined for a couple races, and it did lead to some changes in the sense that PacWest ended their relationship with Galmer and took engineering operations under their own roof in Indianapolis under the head of a guy called Alan McDonald, who IndyCar fans might recognize as an engineer that's been with Team Green and Ray. I think he's with Ray Halls now. So it led to changes within the team. But the other thing it did is it really spurred development of a soft wall. The next year in Brazil, it was essentially like a tire barrier at a road course or a street course, and it was kind of banded together by this conveyor belt-like material. And it's kind of ironic that Gugelmann was the first guy to test it in the race in 97 because he had a gearbox failure and he crashed. And he said it was like sitting down in a chair the first time that he crashed into a soft wall. Now, that particular application didn't work because they found the following year it going to, you know, with the rubber band effect of getting pitched back onto the track. But it was an important step in the development of and it's ironic because I'm sitting out here at the roundabout outside turn one of Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and the speedway was just so instrumental, in creating this. Went into operation in 2002, and I think every oval racer around the world owes a debt of gratitude to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and NASCAR for their part in funding it, and of course Dr. Dean Sicking and the University of Nebraska team that actually did the research and came up with this life-saving device, which is between the Safer Barrier and the Hans device that protects drivers from basal skull fracture. Those are by far the two most important safety advances of the 21st century.
Totally agree on that. We're talking with John Orlovitz on the Great Midwest Bank Hotline. His new book, Time Flies, A History of PacWest Racing, available online. We'll get to that in just a moment. But like you said, you're at the Harvest Grand Prix this weekend, and you had a rare Friday race, which, well, but let's face it, because of the COVID-19 epidemic, IndyCar has to fill out the schedule, and they kind of did the doubleheader with a Friday-Saturday race. I was, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek saying it's probably going to be the lowest-rated IndyCar race ever because it was held on a Friday afternoon on the USA Network. But a very entertaining race, and you know, since they redid that oval at Indianapolis, and I think they did the right thing by getting the driver's input on how to properly maybe do to reconfigure the racetrack or tweak it as they did from when it was a Formula One track. It certainly has become a racier, and then yesterday I thought was a pretty entertaining race. And what can we expect today at the Harvest Grand Prix, John?
I think we're looking at another struggling day for Scott Dixon. He didn't qualify very well again. He's fortunate in the respect that Joseph Newgarden only qualified as well. But these guys are going to try to make chicken salad out of something else today when they're starting that far back in the midfield. Mm-hmm. Dixon's his goal very simply has to be to finish ahead of Newgarden. If he can simply achieve that goal, I think he makes Joseph's possibilities of taking the championship at St. Pete pretty much impossible. But at the same time, you know, Scott's starting 15th or 16th, I forget which. It's a 75 laps instead of 85 laps, and so most people should pretty comfortably be able to do it on this. Yesterday there was definitely a lot of strategy options. So I think if we're looking at a track position day, and Dixon, and I think Newgarden will probably play it pretty conservative. I think Dixon, from where he's at, I think he can afford to gamble more and be one of the guys that maybe goes off strategy and stops early. It's been strange to see the number nine team kind of off game the last three or four races, really since the first race at St. Louis. Scott spun at Mid-Ohio, which is an unforced error. He had another unforced error in yesterday's race that cost him a couple positions, and that's pretty uncharacteristic for him. And it just shows the amount of pressure and the tension that goes into these championship battles, and especially when a guy like Joseph Newgarden and a quality team like Penske gets a little momentum on their side, they can really run with it. So Dixon's mission today is to kind of stop the bleeding. If he can't finish ahead of Newgarden, he needs to finish within two, three, four positions of him, and at least have a 25 or 30 point cushion going into the race at St. Pete, where anything other than a back of the field finish should guarantee him the championship.
Well, John, we lost you there for a second. We're talking with John Orlovitz with his book, The History of PacWest Racing. And, John, if you can hear me, what's the easiest way to get that book?
Well, I wish I could say there was a super easy way. If you go to my website, johnorlovitz.com, I'm trying to re-engineer my website and get a direct link up right now. You can leave a comment on there and with your email address or whatever, and I'd be glad to get back to you. It is available through retail outlets. You can get it through Motorsport Collector in Northern Illinois. You can get it through Coastal 181. Racer Magazine is having a promotion on it right now. It's nice if you order direct from me because it lines my pocket with a little bit more cash, which is always appreciated. And as a benefit, if you order direct from me, and again, just my first name and last name at comcast.net if you want to reach out to me directly. But I do have book plates, custom-made book plates for the books signed by Bruce McCaw that I'd be glad to sign as well. It's always a nice little bonus.
Excellent. Yeah, very good. Well, we will post that on our Facebook site and put that up later today on how to get the book. And, John, we certainly appreciate you taking time out. How's the weather down there today at Indianapolis?
It's funny. My girlfriend was just complaining that it's a little bit too warm. Actually, to me, it's actually perfect for what's being billed as the Harvest Grand Prix. It's 60 degrees. Partly sunny, partly cloudy. It's a crisp fall day. It's the kind of day where I'm going to go watch a car race, drink a couple beers, and then go home and make a fire in the fire pit.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.